Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chiclet that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm an author, a journalist, and the bad boy of the international show jumping set. Joining me is best-selling author and the gypsy lover your husband can't find out about, Jojo Moyes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Today we're here to talk about Riders by Jilly Cooper. Definitely far and away the most requested book on the show. People have been, ever since I even uttered the idea for the show, people have said Riders.
And I got in first. Yeah. I can't believe nobody's done it yet.
Well, I was waiting for the right person.
Oh, well, it ticks all my boxes, I can tell you.
So this is my first time ever reading. I think also I was putting it off. Mm-hmm. Because it's so huge and because I'd never read it before, and I also assumed it was a much sweeter book than it was. I thought it was just people rolling around in Bluebell Woods because of how people speak about it. It's a nasty, mean book.
It's filthy. It's nasty, mean, filthy, full-blooded. It smells of sweat and leather and bad boys that your mother warned you against.
Yeah, oh, it's that fantastic. Book. What's your experience of it? When did you first come to it, and what's your relationship to it?
Oh, we see, most people come to Riders after they've done the gamut of the short Jilly books, the Octavias and, mm-hmm. and all the rest of it.
Which were like young adults, weren't they?
Kind yeah, of. Yeah, but there was, really sort of most people's introduction to sort of slightly racy stories. But actually, I was madly horsey as a teenager.
And, same.
Oh, yeah, and but lived in London, so kind of completely hopelessly.
So just lived in the fantasy world of buying horse magazines.
Basically, yeah. Exactly that, and went to work at the local stables for 20 hours work for 1 hour's ride a week, and I thought this was great. I thought this was really good value.
I used to also do that, and the resentment those people have for day girls is absolutely, like, you'll never feel hate.
No, yeah. No, like, there's nothing bitchier than a stable yard full of teenage girls.
No, my God.
Yeah, cut your teeth there and you survive anyway. After that, it's just it's great. But also, you know, you learn to kind of lug hay bales and and
it's an amazing thing because it's a very I think the horse phase in a woman's life comes after toys and before boys, kind of before boys
most
properly.
Definitely. Some of us never grow out of it.
Yeah, I think a horse girl is a horse girl for life. Will always be drawing pictures of horses on the
definitely.
Back of copybooks.
But I used to be hugely offended when people implied that it was sexual. Because for me, it wasn't sexual, it was romantic. You know, I loved these horses. I loved them. They understood me. We had a kind of telepathic communication that obviously didn't quite extend to them, but I felt it, you know, and they were beautiful and, you know, demanding and capricious and, yeah.
Tell me about the significant horses in your life.
Well, I still have horses.
Do you?
Yeah. Okay, so here's my unusual horse story. Okay. I bought a horse when I was 14 and lived in Hackney, and I kept him behind Hackney Town Hall. I bought him with the proceeds of a cleaning job, and my parents were not remotely horsey. They were both artistic. And I came home and I said, I bought Bombardier, who was this horse I used to look
Bombardier!
And they went,
I love you.
Yeah, right. And I said, no, I have. He cost me £425 and I saved it all up from cleaning. And they looked at each other and they went, well, you can jolly well go and unbuy him. And I went, nope, can't make me. And they told me afterwards that they were actually quite proud of me for doing it, but they couldn't tell me at the time. And I kept him for about 3 years until I A-levels and what have you.
So you kept, and you kept him where?
Behind Hackney Town Hall in a tiny little stable yard under the railway arches.
And how did you pay for that?
With cleaning jobs.
Oh my God, that is the most romantic thing I've ever heard.
And I used to ride on London fields and get chased off by park keepers all the time. There's a whole gang of us, just kind of wild kids on feral horses, basically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And as well, because I think a lot of the work that this book does as well is it sort of, we associate horse owning with kind of an incredibly posh elite set. And those people exist in this book, but there's also the other side of it, of the people who just love and live with horses and don't know anything different.
Yeah, and the endless scrabble for money as well, because they're expensive. It's like it's pretty much the stupidest hobby you could have outside, I don't know, Formula One motor racing in terms of burning money.
Well, like at least in Formula One, your cars don't die suddenly for no reason.
Oh God.
Don't. Sailor!
We have to do Sailor! Yeah, okay, brace yourselves, guys.
So, just quickly, my pony story was... Okay. My cousin trained horses, and she bought a kind of a vaguely abused pony called Gypsy that she wanted me to retrain for her.
Okay.
And then she sold her without telling me, and I've never quite forgiven her.
No, well, I sold my horse for almost no money to people who I thought he would be happy with forever, and they sold him on and wouldn't tell me where they sold him to, and I've never forgiven them either. I looked for him for a while and never... I mean, Jilly Cooper would have enjoyed this plot line. Yeah, it's brutal. So I've never sold an animal since.
My God.
I have all the useless animals, all the useless horses, and I would never sell them because I can't bear it.
Horses are such a good setting for betrayals, aren't they?
Oh, God.
Because there's so many horse betrayals in this book. And we're going to get into it. I'm going to do the plot summary, although I would honestly just talk about our own horse experiences.
The plot summary. I want to hear this because that's 900 pages.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. It was a struggle. So... Riders takes place in the elite English show jumping world, focusing on the lifelong rivalry between Jake Lovell, a half-gypsy upstart who marries money in order to buy his first horse, and Rupert Campbell Black, a charmingly sadistic aristocrat who bullied Jake at school. The two trade blows by stealing horses and trophies from one another, culminating in Jake eventually running off with Rupert's wife Helen on the eve of the Olympic final.
Well done.
Do you think I got that in the paragraph? I feel
like I should applaud you. Yeah, that was hard. Kind of amazing. Yeah.
Obviously, there's a huge cast of characters. Jilly is quite known for them.
Yeah.
Also, another reason why it took me a long time to get into Jilly Cooper, because you open the book and you see three pages of her cast first, where she goes, oh, Rupert.
But her genius is that you remember them. I mean, I was talking to a male friend the other day, and the first thing he remembered was Kevin Coley, the cat food magnate.
Yes.
And I'm like, you're a 50-year-old guy. What just happened? But, you know, every woman I know who's read Riders in their girlhood remembers Rupert Campbell Black.
Rupert Campbell Black.
I mean, he's one of these terrible formative literary influences who slightly ruins you for all other men forever after.
He's such a I mean, basically, we might
as well
start with
him. We could spend an
hour
talking with Rupert, about Rupert, yeah.
What's interesting is because she takes Rupert through, like, five books, I think.
Yes.
The Rutshire Chronicles, they cover different areas and different sports, different industries, but Rupert's always the recurring, he's always the Northern Star.
Yeah.
And she kind of leaves Jake behind. She's done with Jake, really. But Rupert is this character who... he should be unbelievable, you know? You shouldn't believe him as much as you do, but he's so nuanced, and there's such a amazing mix, the right mix of, like, sadism and actual, like, deep loyalty.
Yes.
Like, because there's elements of him that is a truly good person, elements of him that is Satan himself.
Exactly. So his love for Billy, his best friend, is entirely admirable, and because Billy's a good person, you think, well, there must be some good elements in Rupert. And yet his treatment of Macaulay... the horse that he names
after
Helen, who he then abandons to be kind of brutalized in a stone quarry pit, you just think, well, hang on, how can this be the same person? And then, you know, one minute he's charming and flirty and funny, and then he's a bit rapey, you know, and brutal. And, it's awful, really, how we all respond to him because he's just the worst.
I think it's also because he's so funny. Like, he's a genuinely, like, funny person. Like, this is one bit... I just thought it was really tickled me where Helen's saying how she wants him in the delivery room when she gives birth to their first child. And he's like, oh, God, it's too Islington for words.
Yeah. All, I mean, most of his jokes are class-based as well. Like,
they are.
And that's the other thing about Jilly is that although it's a kind of mad romp, and it is, it's just a supercharged sexy romp through the world of show jumping, it is littered with nuanced references to class, sort of Latin references. You know, she wears her knowledge so lightly, and yet it's all in there. And even knowledge of kind of horse stealing and stuff, this stuff that I knew from when I was a kid. And you can tell that she inhabits all these worlds so comfortably that it's never laboured on the page. She just spits it out, kind of scattergun.
It's never that person, that writer as well, and you see so much of it, someone who's done 3 years of research and is desperate to show it.
Show it off, yeah.
It's real candlesticky writing where it's like, and because we were in the Victorian ages, somebody came to do up my buttons. Do you know what I mean? It's just effortless and effervescent and just so... I find it very inspiring just as a writer. A lot of this book I found inspiring just as a writer because at the beginning of their career. I think, first of all, the fact that she can include so many details about people's lives who aren't even that important as characters, like Kevin Coley, the Catholic
But you immediately know who he is.
And using such small details and having faith in her own writing and her own point of view.
The smell of gold spot on his breath. I mean, just like for those of us who grew up in the 80s, there was like this terrible cheap mouth freshener.
Oh,
we all used to squirt our mouths with mouthwash. Gold Spot was the worst. I could still taste it as soon as I read that. But it immediately tells you this guy's a little bit cheap and also slightly too concerned with how he comes across. You would not get Rupert Campbell Black spraying Gold Spot in his mouth. But also,
the great thing about that is, like, I'm not of that generation. Yeah. I don't know what Gold Spot is.
But it tells you.
But the rhythm of the sentence and Gold Spot is just like, it just tells you, I don't even need to know what that is. You know?
I think this is the thing. You talk about the rhythm of the language. I think Gillie is a really underrated writer because to juggle a plot of this size and keep the reader compelled to page turn through 900 pages while really world building in a way that, I mean, I would compare her to Game of Thrones.
Because very like it's that. An and so many perspectives as well.
Political. I mean, there's references to Margaret Thatcher and the strikes, and there's
the IRA references to the IRA in a very kind of funny way.
Yes, but again, I mean, I'm a bit older than you, but it infused our daily life, this fear of bombs in London. You were always conscious that if you're on a tube or whatever, you might get the thing saying. And the fact that she does dot her very jolly romps with kind of little bits of grit here and there just grounds it and makes it a really three-dimensional book in a way that I think a lot of people who don't read her don't get.
Yeah, and I can't believe that I've been doing this podcast for almost a year now and I've read so many books I've never read before and that I can still be surprised because I love that about myself because I did have an idea what writers was. And I think I thought it was much flimsier than it was.
Did you?
And also much, again, that it was just people sort of lifting up trophies and patting horses and feeding sugar lumps and then shagging somebody, which wasn't uninteresting to me, but it wasn't like, I'm not going to pick up a 900-page book.
I mean, it's really about the relationship between the two men. It's just a battle to the death between two men who are of opposing classes, opposing opinions. I mean, you know, everything about Jake and his amazing soft hands and his ability to kind of mend things.
So are you Team Jake or Team Rupert?
Oh, God. It would depend on whether I was ovulating. Sorry, did I actually said that out loud, didn't it? Okay.
No, it makes complete sense though.
Yeah, no, a bit of both. I mean, you'd really want a composite of the two of
them. Helen had it made, honestly.
Oh, she did.
Too much of a whinge to actually know
and actually
that.
Actually, I never quite liked Helen. I felt some sympathy for her, but she got... I mean, I was a Janie girl more than a Helen girl.
And what's funny is, because when Helen gets introduced, you're so prepared to be Team Helen.
Yeah.
Because you're, she's like this, like, sensitive. She loves poetry and, you know, the arts and stuff. But then once you go through, like, this 10 years that this book is...
she's so wearying and uptight and,
And she's so pretentious.
Yes.
And this thing of, like, you know, they're all at, like, this, you know, dinner after a big race or a big class or whatever. And she's like, it's a bit like... Don Quixote, isn't it? Everyone's like, shut up, Helen.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's funny because...
And you should feel bad for her, but you're with them.
You're with them. Like, fuck Helen.
Jesus Christ.
She's so wearying. Yeah. And what's interesting is because you're there reading a book, a thing Helen would do and they would never do.
Oh,
and
that's true.
And you're still like...
And you're still rooting
get your head out of your arse, Helen.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Yeah. And I think as well what this
and
book
And Janie behaves disgracefully. I mean, you know, she's Mrs. Crutchless Knickers, fag out of the mouth, never washes properly, puts on too much weight. Yeah. And yet you kind of root for her all the time as well because she's terrible.
Well, what's interesting, so by the Billy and Janie thing, so we have...
Oh, I loved Billy, though.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
love he's got your sweet, perfect mix of soul. Rupert and Jake, really.
Yeah, except you probably wouldn't sleep with him. I don't know.
I don't know, my standards aren't... Oh, no. But known to be lower.
Day 15.
Day 15!
Oh dear.
A different man for a different place in the cycle, you know?
Exactly.
So their relationship is that, you know, he's always kind of in Rupert's shadow.
I bet you've never had ovulation in your literary podcast before, have you?
I think this is the first time, correct?
I like to be a first,
Although there is actually a wonderful period scene, a wonderfully erotic period scene in this book.
I'm trying to think which.
So there's this bit when Helen and Jake, who have decided to have this affair or whatever, they finally meet up in a hotel. They're finally going to do it, but she's come on.
Oh, right.
And she has terrible cramps and they just lie down and he just, it's so erotic. Yeah. She just puts her head in his lap and he just like massages her tummy and then kind of fingers her. And it's like, there's so much sex in this book. Some of it is highly erotic.
Yep.
Some of it's just fucking really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was just like, I was like, whoo, shiver me timbers. Yeah.
That's cute. But the thing about the sex, I mean, some of it is erotic, some of it is a bit weird. But it's so joyful and unapologetic. And in this age where we're all slightly paralyzed by everything we should and shouldn't be doing and how we look and, you know, there is something so refreshing to return to an age where people just kind of... I mean, even when Jake is first unfaithful to Tori and shags the groom and she says, oh, you know, should you feel better? And he's like, no, it's my reward for a clear round. And you should hate him because Tori's this very sweet... devoted character, and yet you kind of feel like yes you have earned that with your clear round, well done Jake. It's just it's Julie just skews your attitude to sex. I mean, it's so casual and
it's genuinely really refreshing, because I do feel in now that there is a kind of emphasis when you talk about sex in modern novels.
Yeah.
It's like somebody has an affair and then they think about it for 300 pages. And I'm no excuse.
Tortured.
Literally.
Tortured.
Yeah, so tortured.
There's no torturing here.
I think it's, well, apart from horses.
Yeah. Oh, God. No, let's not get on sale yet.
Okay. But, what's interesting is because you have these descriptions of sex next to these descriptions of the animals and what they're doing and their physicality and the tending to of them.
Yes.
They become the same thing.
It's true.
She talks about sex in the same way she talks about horses. It's all very physical. It's like we're all just animals rutting.
Yes. And it's all about... I mean, there is... For all I hated the kind of conflation of the two when I was a teenager... There was also a thing that me and my girlfriends who rode horses knew, which was if you brought your boyfriend along and tried to get him to ride a horse and he couldn't ride, that was it. You could never fancy that person again. There's nothing unsexier than a man who can't ride if you can ride. Because, I mean, it's like a man who can't dance. You kind of assume...
There's nothing going down.
Yeah, there's nothing going down here. It's just not going to work. And yet, if you see a man who can ride really well... Or maybe this is again.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's day 15 stuff again. Maybe I'm just thinking. But it's, it's a physicality. But it's also about you can't ride a horse well without a degree of sensitivity and understanding of the combined physicality of the two of you. You cannot ride a horse well unless you are actually in tandem with the animal. So for a man to do that, you're like, oh, he's listening. He's listening.
It's so true. I never put that together before, but you're absolutely right. I think it's just because I have never really had a horsey man in my life kind of thing. Because I sort of stopped riding when I was about 15. But I did once have a flirty encounter with a traveller, or a gypsy, or whatever you want to call it. A Jake Lovell type.
At
a gymkhana. Yeah, and it was...
At a gymkhana, I love it.
Literally a gymkhana! I was thrown from my horse, I was thrown from gypsy.
Did he pick you up?
He didn't pick me up, but he came up to me and he was like, are you all right? And I was like, yeah. Obviously mortified. And he was like, some amazing writing there. And I was like, I'm going to die.
That's it. That's all he needed to do.
And that was, you know.
Compliment you on your seat.
15 years before I met Jake Lovell, you know.
My step-grandmother, who lived in Ireland and was a great hunter of horses, and she had a gay lad, a champion huntsman at Dublin. And she allowed me to ride him once when I was about 15. It was like riding the kind of Rolls Royce of horses.
Oh.
And we ran around the school a few times, and then she looked at me and she said, you have a very hot seat. And that stayed with me forever. I've never worked out whether it was a compliment or not, but I have a hot seat. Yeah.
It's also hints to the sort of the vague sapphic air of the horse world, which is hinted to, but
I don't
never...
think she meant it like that. But
you know.
Yeah.
What I love as well about their whole world. First of all, I suppose I saw a little bit of it on TV because it would be a slightly bigger sport in Ireland than any kind of horse sport would be in Ireland than it would be in most places. But I thought that when Julie Cooper was talking about these show jumpers who are on the cover of tabloids and like, you know, people really, everyone seems to know about show jumping in this world.
It was huge.
I never understood
it
being
huge in the 70s
huge.
And 80s. I mean, I don't really know why it faded from public consciousness, but
there
were all these amazing characters like the Whittakers, and Harvey Smith used to stick two fingers up at the judges, and And it Caroline, oh gosh, there were all these, we knew them as household names. And if, you know, my great litmus test for all these things were the Giles cartoons in the newspaper. Uh-huh. I've got annuals and they were kind of a feature in there because everybody knew them. You could be working class, you could be middle class or posh. It didn't matter. Everybody knew these show jumpers. And then weirdly, it's just sort of lost popularity. I'm not entirely sure why.
It's very interesting. I had a conversation on Twitter with the author Susanna Forrest, who wrote Year of the Horse. Yeah. Fascinating woman. She knows everything about horses.
Yeah, she really does.
Really, my kind of, I have to have her on. But so she mentioned several reasons which I found very fascinating. First of all, Kevin Coley, the cat magnate, there was a trend for renaming horses to fit whatever brand sponsor.
So they stopped being characters.
They stopped being recognisable. There was like literally horses called like Sony HDTV or whatever.
Oh my God, that's so interesting.
So that's one thing. So they stopped being recognisable. Yeah, yeah. And second of all, the more we moved away from this world where everyone kind of knows a little bit about horses, everyone has an uncle or a cousin who has a horse.
Yeah.
You stopped understanding how hard the sport is.
Yeah.
And that's what you really get in this book, is that you get how difficult it is. You're very aware of the strides between jumps, about like, you know, the power of an animal, like what animals like and don't like, what they'll do and won't do.
And she's entirely accurate. You know, this is when you realise that she really knows this world. And in fact, when you go, I went to Julie's house once.
Tell me.
And you realise that this is her world. So it that's why it comes out so naturally on the page, because this is her house. Penshurst is her house. Penscombe,
yeah.
Is her house. And, you know, her husband was a bit naughty. And I'll tell you a story, which I'm sure if Julie hears this, she won't mind me repeating. But I had basically the best day at her house. And when you go to Julie's house, it's champagne all the way. And then
did she invite you there as a fellow author or as a fellow horsewoman?
No, I think I was meant to be writing a feature, but the feature kind of went out the window because I just fell in love with Julie. And Leo, her husband, her late husband, sadly. She has this amazing... It's the first thing I felt when I walked into this house, and it's this lovely old Cotswold stone, kind of huge, rambling, shabby house.
Yeah.
I've never felt a house more suffused in love than this house was. Oh. You know, and sometimes you walk in and it literally comes out of the vaults and the floor, and it just felt like a house that had been so filled with love. And it, you know, there were dogs on sofas and cats, and everything was a bit scratched and shabby in a kind of really pleasing way. But they have this amazing art collection, and Julie went out of the room to do something, and Leo, who was quite frail at the time, he said, just shut that door a minute and look at the picture behind the door. I want you to tell me something. And I sort of wandered over to the painting, worked out which one he was pointing at. And it was an absolutely filthy picture of someone giving a woman cunnilingus. And he said, what do you think of that then? And I just turned around and I thought, oh, I know what you're doing. So I said, I think it's a very nice picture of a man giving a woman cunnilingus. And he hooted with laughter. And Julie came in and she was like, oh, Leo, you haven't done that again, have you? And it was obviously, he was just having a game. I loved them both after that. And literally I had to be peeled from their house later that evening because I just didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay with Julie forever. I adore her.
What an absolute, like, once in a lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, she sends me Valentine's cards and she sends me little notes. And you can always, they're always really eccentric notes, and she has this amazing scrawly handwriting. And yeah, I got one this year and it was my favourite Valentine because it comes from Julie. She's just and she's so smart. She like the book, she wears her knowledge so lightly. Mm. She likes to present herself as someone who is kind of daffy and
she does.
A bit giddy, but there's a steely intelligence inside there. I don't mean that as a derogatory way. Mm. I mean she knows so much, and she has such a huge classical reference. But she's just amazing.
She's really, it really, whenever you hear an interview with her or anything, I listen to a few. It's so apparent to her that charm is so important to her, both her own and other people's. It's like she just wants to make people comfortable.
Yes,
which is what these books do.
And that's why I worried that I'd completely outstayed my welcome, because she's the kind of person who would just put you up for a week rather than suffer the embarrassment of having to say, darling, darling, I think you need to leave now.
an incredible experience.
It really was.
You've picked out a few bits to read from the book.
Yeah.
I really want people to understand how funny, how sharp, how, like, honestly, I was saying before we started recording that you could do a Who Said It, Dorothy Parker or Julie Cooper, and make a pretty good game of it.
Well, this particular quote is not going to sit in the Dorothy Parker world, but it's one of those, I mean, it's so funny, when I've told people I was doing this podcast and doing Riders, everyone has a quote. Everyone really? Remembers something. And this was mine, which is somebody asking, Janie talking to Billy about Rupert. And she says, do you think he's good in bed? Billy says, cock like a baseball bat. Used to bat bread rolls across the room with it when we were at school. Now, when I read that, I think I was about 14. I had never seen a male member. That set me up for a lifetime of disappointment. No one has ever batted a bread roll with their penis in front of me. That's not a challenge, by the way. I will be dodging bread rolls from now on in. Oh, but I just thought that was such an extraordinary mental image. But yeah, it like, kind of ruined me forever, really. Because yeah, everything since then has been a vague disappointment.
Yeah. And we were also, like, it's also the point of there was no porn, really. No readily available porn.
No.
When and this so, came out.
Yeah, we had, I remember Lace, that was the other big yes. one in the 80s, and it was most of us. But, basically the big sexy thing that everybody remembered, sexy in a kind of slightly weird way, was the goldfish.
Yes.
I don't know if I should go into details, but a goldfish was inserted into a part of a woman's anatomy. Where
that should never have a goldfish.
Which I'm sure would attract the ire of the RSPCA, were it to happen today, quite rightly. But we were all fascinated by this. But it has about as much resemblance to everyday sex as, you know, I do to Naomi Campbell. It's just not, it's not a thing.
Yeah.
So Gilly, however, suggested that sex was kind of matter of fact, every day, as normal as eating, you know, yeah. going to the brushing your teeth, you just fitted in a quickie here and there, and it was joyful. It was joyful and unanguished and fun. And
there's actually a brilliant quote that you have here about adultery, I think.
Oh, yeah. That was brilliant as well. Rupert says, hunting's like adultery, endless hanging about, interspersed with frenzied moments of excitement, very expensive and morally indefensible. I mean, that's perfect.
That is a perfect
line. It's a perfect line, yeah. I mean, the one thing you could say about Rupert, and I don't know quite how Gilly manages to keep him pretty much on the right side of it, but there's almost too much punning. You know, I'm not sure a man like him would pun quite as emphatically as he does all the way through. There's a lot of
I do know what you mean, but I also think there is a kind of a that sort of like aristocratic British man who has never read a book in his life, but there's a kind of a sense of wordplay to everything
they've sort of picked it up by osmosis over the years.
Yes, and it's very that
from
sort
the library
of like
in the stately home.
Yeah, standing up by the fireplace telling riddles kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's very much of that life.
But the other thing is, Gilly is really unafraid of, and I'm going to say this word, so brace yourselves, she's unafraid to call a cunt a cunt. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of cunts in this book. And
everyone's a cunt in this book.
Fairly, oh, God, yeah. But, I mean, there are a lot of literal cunts in this. And there's one sex scene that everyone was obsessed by, which was Billy and Janie for the first time in the field. Mm-hmm. But it refers to, where is it? There was a snail trail running down her leg.
I winced, yeah.
I know, and apparently her publishers were like, are you sure you want to put this in? Because it's, you know, that's fairly graphic. And, you know, it's like you thought this was going to be a sweet little tale about horses and medals and stuff.
Yeah.
It's filth. I think that's the thing.
I did expect the filth, but I thought it was going to be breathy, more Mills and Booney, I think.
No.
More kind of like, and he seized her and her breasts
no,
and
it's
blah.
No, it's matter of fact.
But that is so, like, gynecological.
Oh, no, I tell you when the snail trail is. The snail trail is when Rupert is taking pictures of his plump little groom.
Yes, which is also a very sexy scene.
Yes, and posing her and
Morally indefensible.
Morally indefensible. I mean, here's the thing. You have to leave all your Me Too age objections at the door when you pick up this book. This is not politically correct in any way. I mean, it has some slightly unreconstructed scenes that make the, you know, 20-something, 2019 reader wince, you know, but you have to kind of accept it is of its time.
You're in Gilly's world
you're
now,
in Gilly's
you
world.
Mean?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and she doesn't care. So
it's kind of the same as like, sort of like covering your hair when you go into a temple.
Exactly. Like, this is the reverse.
Adopt the rules of the system you're in. Do you know what I mean? You can't change it. It's here now.
But there's something kind of refreshing about it as well. It's just, it's just like, I would rather, I don't know, oh God, I'll get myself in trouble, but I would rather my 21-year-old daughter read that, Gilly, than 50 Shades, which I think gives a far stranger message about female sexuality.
I agree. I agree. I've been kind of toying with whether or not to do 50 Shades in the podcast, and I've decided not to. First of all, because it's been talked to death.
Yes, that's true.
And second of all, because I do garbage, but I do good garbage. Do you know what I mean? It's not a good book.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I love the term garbage. Yeah, I'm proud to be garbage, and I'm proud to read this garbage. It's so not garbage. It's ironic, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just yummy.
Yeah, but you know that if you knew nothing about sex, if you'd heard it described and never actually experienced it, you would come away from this book thinking, oh, yeah, give me some of that.
Right.
That looks great. You know, that sounds great. That looks like it feels great. So much of what we read, especially, I mean, in literary fiction, I feel like I've judged a couple of literary prizes and I lost count of the number of abused young women, you know, having tortured sex lives with people who were older or should know better. Do you know what? Rupert is older and should know better. You would shag him in an instant. You just would.
So I had this issue. So my first book that came out last year, it is an older man, a younger woman sort of relationship, and it is all kind of wrong or whatever, but it was so important to me that even though he's an obviously a wrong'un, that the sex is hot. Do you know what I mean? Because she wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
No, exactly.
You know, and just having these things where it's like, girl staring miserably at ceiling while man just has his way is like, no, can't do it.
And actually a lot of 17-year-old girls are quite filthy and knowing. And
oh,
you know,
yeah.
The appetite with which this was swept up in my school.
I actually think the sex I had before I was 20 was filthier than the sex I was having now. Because I was ingesting all these ideas from so many different sources and just pairing them together.
What were you reading?
Oh, Flowers in the Attic.
Oh, well, see, there you go. Yeah. It's so off. It's so weird.
It's so mad, yeah.
Oh, and what was the other one with Father Ralph Brookes?
The Thornbirds, which is the episode that just went out today.
All right, well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, we had some quite odd messages about sex from all these books, which is basically it's all a bit warped and
what
weird.
What I love about sex in this, first of all, I'm really interested in sort of the bonk buster as area of study.
Uh-huh.
Because my theory on this is these books, these kind of 700-page books with a sex scene every 10 pages, they came of age and of popularity in the era of the package holiday, right?
Ooh.
Where you take one book with you on holidays.
And it lasts you.
It has to last you because you're going to like probably a place in Spain that doesn't have an English bookshop. There's no internet. You want to feel a bit sexy on your holidays. I think now the trend is to like load up 10 short books on your Kindle so you feel like, I think people are like, oh, I have to do all my reading on my holidays, so I'm taking these 7 books
and
with me.
And I have to be seen to be reading the right books.
But that didn't exist then.
No,
that whole culture didn't exist. It's just having a huge book where you could sort of like lie in front of the pool and be like, have a bit of sex and then just like do something a bit sexy with whoever you went on holidays with.
That's true. But also thinking about those bunkbusters is that the vast majority of them, apart from, I mean, I was thinking about the really big, the sort of Sidney Sheldons and everything, they were always written with the male gaze.
Yeah.
Gilly's writing, even when she's writing about men, who she does very well, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not, you know, I think most men,
I think if any man were to, if any man ever asked me the question, which they never do, which sentimental garbage book would I love the most? I think writers would be it. It's about men.
Yeah.
It's about men and how they
and competition.
The David and Goliath of it all.
Full of testosterone.
You know?
It just it's very ridey, as you say.
Yeah.
So it's like
ridey.
But it's so much from it's a male gaze, but through a female prism. So even you know the slightly off scene with Rupert abusing his position with his groom.
Yeah.
You sort of see it, but it's written in a way that titillates women as much as men, and not in a kind of weird, creepy way like some of the 50 Shades stuff did for me, I'm afraid. It just to me, the whole conflation of sex and money just throws me.
Mm.
Whereas this is not. This is just about, they want to sleep with Rupert because he's hot. They don't want to sleep with him because of anything it's going to get them, and most of them are having affairs with him in secret, so it's not even if they can tell anybody. They just want a bit of that. I mean, because Gilly's always writing.
Like,
she writes about him and his physicality with the same lust as she writes about the women. So, you know, yes, Janie has kind of bouncing boobs that never wears a bra and she's just kind of all over the place. But, you know, Rupert's muscles and his torso and
the thighs
that could crack a wall. You know, she goes there again and again and again. You're just never left in any doubt as to what this man looks like. And it's gorgeous,
and she even like name checks sort of Robert Redford, and you know, and his clothes are always immaculate as well, and it's just, and also it's this thing of like,
that's why so many of us were so disappointed with the TV series, because we had all built this man into something kind of superhuman, and then you just get this actor who
I think I actually watched the show, and I think Jake Lovell is very hot, so Team Jake people will love him. But yeah, the actor who plays Rupert, he plays it very well. Yes. He's very charming and sadistic. He gets that balance perfect.
But there's physicality face, that is just not there.
He looks like a long string of piss.
Yeah.
His face is kind of strange. Yeah. He's got these very, very big eyebrows and very tiny eyes.
He looks like someone you might have met at sixth form college.
Yeah. It's kind of just that posh guy.
He has to be just, he's mythical.
Yeah. And that thing of, like, even women who hate him, even women who have been bred their entire, like, Fenella.
Also Helen's appalling hairy armpited friend.
Hillary.
And I have nothing against hairy armpits. It's just that this is used. Yeah. Hillary's armpits are used as a kind of indicator for the kind of... She's a Guardian reading. I mean, God bless her. Jilly does not have much sympathy for the lefties of the world. I don't think she would...
are called, like, Germaine.
Yeah, I don't think Corbyn would have got much action in this book.
No. oh, God, I would love to see
but,
that.
But, yeah, even Hillary, who despises everything that Rupert stands for, finds herself unable to resist his, you know, studly charms. And their sex scenes are quite amusing as well.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Do you know what I actually love about this? Because there are so many relationships that kind of go nowhere. They just peter out. So Hillary and Rupert have Finn for about 30 pages.
And then you never see her again.
And then Billy and Fenn, and Fenella, they have this romance that you think, oh, this is going to be the romance. But then he goes back to his wife. And actually, that marriage works out oddly. What I loved about it, and it made me feel great as both a writer and as a human being of like, bad things just happen to people and they move
on.
And
it's random and you just get over
it. People just move on with their lives and like have slightly fractious relationships with each other going forward, but it's kind of fine, you know?
And actually that's interesting because in a lot of books, if you had that kind of affair or if you had, you know, people snapping at each other in the way that they do, that would be an indicator that it's all gone. It's all gone. But as you say, Jilly just makes that a matter-of-fact part of life and, you know, they get together or they don't and it's kind of fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People just carry on.
Oh, you've just reminded me of another phrase that has popped into my head all my life of Jilly's, which is two people going at each other with the helpless snappings of courtship, which I always thought was just brilliant. That kind
that
of
is fab.
Isn't it? Yeah, I think I've used that myself.
The helpless snappings of courtship.
And you know exactly what that is from that one phrase.
Oh, I love it. I love everything about it so much. another thing I love about it as well, and maybe you relate to this as a very famous lady writer, that thing of like they're very good at these people who are incredibly famous and well known, and how their lives are just like about four times a year they're the most important people on the planet. And the rest of the time, they're just slogging away in near poverty, in cold houses, up at six, like nursing their horses or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have very drab lives when they're not competing.
Yes, you know, no, she's great on the dichotomy between the two sides of their existence. And also just the slog it takes to keep that thing going, the kind of anxiety of being dropped from the team repeatedly and the depression. I mean, the professional athletes... absolute depression when you're dropped and also all the things that might lead to you to be dropped. So, I mean, you can imagine footballers reading this and identifying because too much drinking, too much carousing, and then eventually your captain goes, you know what, you're out. You're out this time. I think she's really good on that
And you're
mentality.
Devastated for them, and having to watch
each other.
And
also the impact on your family, you know, and they're like, oh, God, he's going to be in a terrible mood now for the next however long. She's so good on human psychology, but again, it's all done so lightly. You know, none of this is hammered home in a kind of arduous way. I think the thing, I hadn't read this for about 15 years when I came back to it. It's just one of those books that stays in your head. So I thought, I'll try and read all 900 pages, which I almost did. But the thing that really leapt off the page as someone who's not read Jilly for a while was the life in it, the buoyancy of the prose. It just... I mean, it's almost too much, but there's never a paragraph without some kind of zing in it. She's just, there's no slack, basically. It just keeps bouncing along. And yeah, it's like Gilly talking, basically. You feel this thing has spilled out
and
of
her. It's that so great thing about narration, though, because it is a sort of third-person omniscient narration.
And it's a bit peculiar, because she does switch
viewpoints
a lot in a way that, if I'd read it from somebody else, I would be quite critical, but somehow she gets away with it.
Yes, an editor now would be like, you're head-hopping here. Yeah. This, you know,
head-hopping, I like that. Yeah.
I get that criticism quite a bit. What was I going to say? Yes, so she has this third-person omniscient narrator.
Yeah.
But just because they're omniscient, it doesn't mean they're not biased.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a bit opinionated. And she's quite judgy as well. Like, there's all sorts of... I mean, the class thing... You can tell that she's desperately snobby about some people. And even though it's the narrator writing, you can tell that she looks down on Kev and his gold spot and his gold chains and you know, various people who...
And it's that thing that they always say about people who are, you know, very, very upper class or whatever, the kind of the Ruperts of the world, is that they get on with the working classes, but not the middle classes, because they see them sort of just grasping and kind of...
And actually, I would say that's probably true in this book as well. I would say she's far more critical of the Hillarys and the lefties and the you know, the people.
The upwardly mobile middle class. Yeah. She's like, get out of it.
Mrs. Bodkin or, you know, the grooms or whatever, or the Jake, people at the bottom, or Jake, she has huge sympathy with. Basically, anyone who likes animals, she has huge sympathy with. And anybody who is an animal-y, she's not interested in. So Hillary obviously would have no pets. She would just stroke the hair under her armpits.
Yeah, and it kind of, we know what to think of Helen because of how she feels about the dogs.
Yes, there you go. That's it. That's the indicator. Yeah. You're either in or you're out, and it's all to do with the animals.
And my secret favourite character is Mavis the dog.
Oh, Mavis.
Well, we just first meet Billy for the first time, and he's feeding Mavis some Easter egg.
Yes, which actually is poisonous
for dogs.
We should make that point. Do not give your dogs chocolate, or if they eat chocolate, take them up straight to the vet.
Well, obviously, and obviously Gilly probably knows that too, but it's like, it's the rhythm of feeding a dog some Easter egg. It's just so lovely.
Yeah, and actually, Rupert and Billy's love for their animals, or their dogs, actually, because Rupert's treatment of horses. And in fact, when he gets on... Is it Revenge? Oh, no, it's Macaulay, who goes mad and tries to kill him. I mean, she anthropomorphizes the animals to a kind of terrible degree, one which I probably wouldn't tolerate in anybody else. But you're so with it because they just become extra members of the cast.
Horses aren't really like that, do you know what I mean?
No.
Like, they're not like dogs, and they kind of are portrayed like dogs.
Yeah, well, they do have some... I mean, I have a horse at home, my daughter's horse, who is very expressive. And quite opinionated, but no, not to the degree that they would. I mean, I remember reading an article with an interview with an actor recently where he stated that a horse that he'd ridden for a film 4 years previously remembered him, and I thought, yeah, right, mate.
He didn't. I've ridden horses for twice a week for 3 years, and since I have no idea who I am.
Exactly. Or he did. He just didn't care. But you think that if it makes you happy,
We should probably wrap up unless we have more to say.
Is it all gone? Oh, we should talk about Sailor. The death of Sailor. There is a proper tragedy.
Tell me all about Sailor.
We're not ruining. Sailor is the ugliest horse in the world, and he's a horse that Jake brings on and saves and turns into a show jumping champion, and in the way of the underdog becomes a great crowd favorite as well.
Yes.
And Jake
very
is
much
made,
a Seabiscuit.
Exactly. Yeah. And Jake is made to overjump him, overface him at a point when he would rather not. He feels that Sailor has been a good boy and should be put away to rest, and instead he's told by the Malise Gordon, the chef to keep, that he must ride another round. And poor Sailor, I'm sorry, block your ears if you haven't read this. Sailor dies, and it is genuinely the most harrowing thing that happens in the book, far more so than
any of the interpersonal things.
Tori trying to commit suicide or anything, none of that is as painful. Oh, maybe Wolf dying.
But that's done so quickly. Like, that's not given the gravitas
Sailor,
it needs. Yeah.
Yeah, it broke me
just
rereading it.
He literally comes off the course with a clear and just...
And then collapses. And also you realise that Jake loves this horse more than he can express love to any human being. So there isn't... You know, a man crying is going to break you, full stop.
Yeah.
But a man crying over a broken horse who he... Oh, look, she's welling up. She's welling up.
I'm very easy crying over this.
No. And it's a really well-written piece of To say melodrama makes it sound derogatory. It's not. It's heartbreaking.
And then what happens directly after that is, so he has the two Olympic horses, two Olympic hopefuls, our sailor who dies, and
then
revenge.
He goes to revenge. But doesn't he then go to find Macaulay?
He does. So yeah. So revenge gets was bought by his father-in-law.
Yeah.
So the father-in-law owns him. He's not racing. He's not jumping.
No, Jake is bringing revenge on quite slowly and carefully, as is Jake's want. Jake and his magic hands.
And Rupert, gypsy medicines.
Rupert basically steals him through a mixture of kind of
manipulation
charm and manipulation, and manages to steal the horse from under him and does all the things that Jake would never do, which is sort of metaphor for Rupert and Jake, full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he ends up going to the Olympics and winning like a silver on revenge. And then Jake goes after Macaulay, who's named after the maiden name of Rupert's
Helen,
wife,
yeah.
of Helen, who he's sold to the Middle East.
Yes, and then left
in a stone quarry.
Perish in a stone quarry.
Which is this whole metaphor for just Rupert and his wife, which is so on the nose, but
it's
perfect.
It's Gatsby's Careless Rich People.
Yes.
Yes, it's like, toss away the horse once you're done with it.
Yeah.
Couldn't care less. And we should hate Rupert for that. We should.
And yet, Rupert comes good in the end.
And yet you still would.
You still bloody would. Whatever day of the cycle, Rupert's in.
Day 15, day 1, whatever.
But the thing is, like, so Rupert, like, does he abuses this horse.
Yeah.
He abuses his wife.
Yeah.
And Jake kind of has this...
He picks up the pieces.
But he has a sort of weird fixation with taking the things that Rupert abuses.
Damages.
Because he's been abused by Rupert himself. And just sort of caring for them and bringing them back up to this competitor level.
To show Rupert.
Yes,
yeah.
To show
no,
Rupert.
I mean, that the kind of competition and deep enmity between the two men is what fuels this book. It's actually not about horses. It's about two men in a kind of slightly homoerotic relationship of hatred and, power and lust. And it's,
like, even to the point where the first time they meet... So Rupert bullies Jake
at
boarding
school.
The first time they meet again in adult life properly, Jake is on the other side of the hotel room door listening to Rupert bang Helen. Like, that's the first time he's made aware of Rupert again in his adult life.
So here's the question. How would you know
that
was who it was?
Oh,
really?
He's spying on Helen on the balcony because she's in the...
I missed that scene. Right, I should have... I might have to go back.
This
is the thing. Things happen at such a rate. You could probably have two sex scenes on one page. And, you know, a medal and a dog dying. You could have that all on one page. It is impossible to get everything at once in this. But this book probably does take several rereadings.
What do you think of the ending?
I think it's good that Jake ended up with Tori.
Yes. Oh, we haven't even talked about Tori.
Lovely Tori.
Just, like, lovely Tori, who is... That's my one thing that actually made
She's
me uncomfortable in the book.
She's the centre of the book, really.
Yeah.
She's just the essence of goodness. And I'm not... Yeah, I think the whole suicide thing and...
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually came back for the dog more than he came back
He came
for
back
Troy.
For the dog just, to find... Yeah. It's a very Victorian ending. It
but
feels like Victorian fiction.
Yeah, there's a bit of kind of weight... there's a sort of unreconstructed attitude towards bodies in terms of how we view people through size and shape that perhaps feels a little bit old-fashioned.
It's the only thing about this book I truly didn't like.
Yeah.
Was the... And not just talking about weight, but being very empirical about it.
Yes.
It's like, we always know how much stone.
Yes.
All these women who are 8 and 9 stone, I don't know how they're even lifting up their own heads. And then the worst thing is, like, I think maybe this felt very attacked. It's just like Tori is referred to as being like this monstrously fat.
And she's not.
She's not. She's 11 stone.
I know.
And also tall.
Yes.
My exact weight.
And huge tits.
And
so
huge
like
tits.
Half of that might be tits.
But it's a thing where, like, she's always referred to as being this great galumphing...
Yes, I know.
...thing, which is... Whatever weight she was, it would be horrible.
Yeah.
And it's horrible for any reader to have to be like, oh, in the world of this book, I am seen as being this undesirable, terrible thing, you know?
I think we have to, again, say we leave our modern, slightly more... what's the word? Our more evolved viewpoints at the door and just accept it for what it is.
Even when Tori kills herself or tries to kill herself because she does, there's no life without Jake for her, he comes back into her sick bed. He's like,
because that's all right then.
She's dying, but those cheekbones.
So that's all right then.
Yay. Maybe, you know, let's hope she doesn't put back on the post-illness weight.
That would be bad.
But also, Rupert, who's obviously done all these terrible things throughout. Yeah. So Jake runs out with Helen on the eve of the Olympic final. Rupert has a dislocated shoulder. And he does a clear round and gets the Olympic gold with a trapped nerve in his shoulder in excruciating pain. And he's the hero. Superhuman.
Yeah.
But and like you're reading it, and he's there with Fenn and
Dino.
Ivor.
Ivor,
who is barely a character, but just a bit of an idiot. And he's like there, and they're getting like, he's like, oh, a schoolgirl, a cripple, and a schoolgirl, a cripple, and an idiot, not bad. And we took on the whole world. And I started crying.
But that's the thing, you're locked into Julie's world by then. There is no resistance to be had.
You're so into the team, you know? Yeah,
it's the team. But then, did you ever watch the film International Velvet?
National Velvet is the one with Elizabeth Taylor, isn't it?
International Velvet is like the cheese fest of show jumping granddaughter of... it's a televisual... a filmic equivalent of sentimental garbage for, you know, show jumping girls. Oh, and it's fab. Young Tatum O'Neill being a troubled teenager. All the same kind of dynamics. It's all about the team. And, you know, it's hilarious.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to get into that. If you were making it again today, who would you cast?
Ooh, good question.
Yeah.
Do you know, there just isn't anybody.
There's no Rupert, really.
There's no Rupert.
Yeah, because you can imagine everybody else. You can see like a, you know.
Oh, Jake could be played by any number of people.
Yeah, just handsome black-haired people.
Yeah, Helen, is that, oh gosh, she's that amazing, of course I can't think of any of the names, but there are lots of amazing foxy red-headed American women who could play
an Isla Fisher or something.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And Amy Adams even.
Amy Adams. Oh, yeah. She'd be perfect because she could do that slightly tremulous quality. Yeah, which Helen has. I feel like Helen is rake thin. I don't know why I think that.
There's
a lot of reference to her tiny breasts
and her whippetness.
Yeah. Who else? I mean, Fenn could be any jolly, beautiful sort of young Gwyneth Paltrow-y type person.
We haven't even spoken about Fenn at all, which means that I don't think either of us are that interested in her.
Well, she's just an every woman, really, isn't she? I feel like she's the most every girl, you know, pony mad. She's the pony girl you dreamt of being, the one who actually achieves Olympic glory and the men slightly fancy.
And even though she's only 16, she's still the athlete of the year.
Exactly.
And she gets to have loads of... It's like a character from a pony book.
Hat hair, which is actually a huge feature of horse riding.
Yes, the kind of the static...
The sweaty head afterwards. None of these people have hat hair.
No.
Or actually, if the men do, it doesn't matter because they're just generally sweaty and delicious. Yeah.
Beautiful. We're going to stop there. You have a book out today, The Giver of Stars.
Yeah, which has horses in it, funny enough. But the very unanthropomorphized horses.
You've done a horse book before, though, haven't you?
I did. I did a horse book and then...
Is that your first or very early on?
Well, no, I often shoehorn a reference to riding somewhere in there. And I wrote a book called The Horse Dancer, which was about dressage. Ah. I know, sexy, huh? And then after I wrote it, I remember my editor at the time saying, well, yeah, the thing is, if you put horse on the cover of a book, immediately your sales drop by about 60% because people either love them or hate them.
Opposite of dogs.
Yeah, you could have told me that before I wrote it. But actually, it's fine now. It's done quite well. And in fact, it's just been filmed in Germany, so I'm quite excited to see
what the Germans do with it. Pushing it again because I saw it in W.H. Schmidt the other day.
It had a second life. It was really bizarre. It just went to number two or something. I can't remember what it did. It just had some weird leap up in... Oh, yeah, but it's a young girl and a horse. I mean, we never escape that, I think. If you're a horsey girl, there's always a young girl and a horse. But this is about women... I wanted to write about women having agency and doing something athletic and brave and serious and supporting each other. I didn't want to write a book about women in competition with each other for men. I wanted to write a book about women achieving something as a team, having that kind of funny, irritated, fractious, loving, supportive relationship that women do with each other. But also there's some hot men in there.
Oh,
and it's
lovely.
A bit more full-blooded. Ginny would approve of this one. It's a bit more full-blooded than my usual thing. There is sex.
Yummy.
Actual sex.
Yes. Well, I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much, Judge and Voice, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having
me. This has been an absolute joy.
For me too.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho. Off we go.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at sarahlineodonoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.